From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a Sacramento man who's one of the writers of the long-running soap opera Guiding Light, about to be cancelled by CBS. Also, poets laureate from around California converging on Sacramento for a big reading and a new anthology of their work. And a song or two from a local production of The Gondoliers, the comic opera by Gilbert and Sullivan. But first, will science explain away spirituality? That question is at the heart of a new book, The End of Materialism, by Charles Tart, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at UC Davis and a faculty member of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto. In the book, he cites research that claims evidence of paranormal phenomena. He joins us by phone. Charles Tart, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, many people get puzzled or even concerned when they hear about evidence of the paranormal. They say there's no such evidence. Could you give us an example of something paranormal that you say is supported by evidence?
Well, how about if I summarize for you several hundred experiments dealing with telepathy?
Well, maybe one or two.
I mean, your basic experiment to see whether there's something paranormal is that you set up a situation which by ordinary standards is impossible. So if we didn't have this telephone connection, for instance, I could talk a blue streak here in Berkeley and you wouldn't hear a word I was saying. But if you set up an experiment that shows that some of that information gets through anyway and there's no known physical connection to account for that information, then you have a parapsychological, a paranormal event.
Isn't that just something that will at some point be explained scientifically, but just we don't know the answer yet?
Well, I hope it will be explained scientifically, but if you mean will it be explained in terms of a reasonable extension of contemporary science, I don't think so. That's why I called the book The End of Materialism. Our ordinary material science can't seem to deal with something like telepathy or precognition. It doesn't make sense in those terms.
When you say telepathy, give us a definition. What does that mean?
It means literally picking up the thoughts in another person's mind.
And how can that be done?
The classical way it was done was, well, the oldest way would be to have somebody select a picture at random and look at it, and somebody off in another room would try to draw what the picture was. That got some interesting results, but it was very subjective to judge whether it was actually accurate enough or not. So long ago, they devised multiple choice tests, card guessing tests, really, where a person in one room would go through a deck of cards slowly trying to send what they were while a person in another room wrote down the order. And that way it was a simple matter of counting. Did you have more than you would expect by chance? And dozens of experiments like that have produced significant results. Not 100%. Nobody tunes in totally like that. But in addition to just guessing, you get some extra hits once in a while.
How much of this research is research that you have personally been involved with?
Oh, probably about 0.1%.
Yes.
This has been going on for 100 years now. So, you know, I've made certain kinds of contributions to it, but I'm part of a small part of a big enterprise.
I'm talking with Charles Tart. He's author of the book The End of Materialism, How Evidence of the Paranormal is Bringing Science and Spirit Together. He's professor at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto and is professor emeritus of psychology at UC Davis. What does that mean, the end of materialism?
Well, my big concern is that everything I know as a psychologist, as well as my personal life, tells me there's some real and important sense in which we're spiritual creatures. But materialistic science, what people think of as science, says, no, that's all nonsense. You know, there's no spirits or gods or prayers. You know, that's all old superstitious nonsense. Well, if you deny a part of a reality, then psychologically you pay a price for that. My big concern in writing about the end of materialism is to say that materialism is a great philosophy for investigating certain material kinds of things, but it's not the same thing as science. And when you actually apply proper science, you find that human beings have qualities we would expect a spiritual being would have. So it's not so crazy to take your spiritual side seriously. You can be crazy about it, of course, like you can be in any area of life, but it's not inherently crazy.
I want to cycle back to something we were talking about a little earlier, and that is Do you believe that there are things, phenomena of one kind or another, that exist but that will never be able to be explained scientifically?
Well, I think that might be possible, but I don't think it's useful to think about that sort of thing, because that's saying there are things I can't figure out, so I'll go crazy if I try to figure them out. Why bother?
Yeah.
I assume there's some lawfulness in this, that we'll find principles that, science will gradually tease out. Whether there's stuff beyond that, could be. I don't know. I'm not that smart.
Well, you are a scientist. You have been for many decades, and I'm sure you have colleagues who say, well, you know, if it can't be explained scientifically, then why are we bothering with it?
Well, that depends on what you mean to explain scientifically. If you mean I can't explain it in terms of the already commonly accepted theories, then, yeah, that's the nature of paranormal phenomena and what makes them so interesting, that they are exceptions, that they don't fit in. But science is not a matter of making everything fit into what you already know. Science is a matter of trying to objectively figure out what actually is and being open-minded about that and testing it.
Your book is subtitled How Evidence of the Paranormal is Bringing Science and Spirit Together. What does that mean, bringing science and spirit together? Aren't they, by definition, separate?
No. What's inherently separate is scientism, not science. This is one of the things people are very much confused about. We take some scientific discoveries at a given period. Take it now, take it 10 years ago, 100 years ago. People get arrogant about that, and they think, okay, we know everything important about the world now, and anything that doesn't fit with that framework can't be true. But that's scientism. That's hardening your beliefs into a final doctrine of absolute truth. Science is really about saying, okay, what's actually out there? How can we make sense of it? Let's keep looking. There's no real conflict between genuine science, or essential science as I call it, and looking at the possibility of reality in the spiritual area. Scientism dismisses it absolutely, but that's a philosophy, that's not science.
Earlier you mentioned precognition. What does that mean?
That means predicting the future when it's inherently unpredictable. You know, if I say the sun's going to rise tomorrow, big deal. I mean, that's just one of the regularities of life. But if I say tomorrow a green car will come around the corner as you're walking to work and almost hit you, and there'll be a driver wearing a blue hat in it, and that comes out to be true, hey, that's not predictable in advance. Now, again, you know, the outside events like that are hard to judge, but there are laboratory tests where basically you tell someone, an hour from now, I'm going to shuffle this deck of cards very thoroughly without looking at it. But would you write down now what the order of that deck is going to be? If you get more than chance there, that means that sometimes the mind is picking up something from the future. And if you have a hard time understanding that, I'm with you. I have a hard time understanding how in the world that could possibly be. But the results come out and show that it happens sometimes.
Are you saying that there's peer-reviewed research that shows examples of precognition?
Yes. Several thousand studies by now, actually. Although this is a very small area of science, as I say, it's been going on for 100 years, and a lot of evidence has added up. Now, of course, people who believe that it can't possibly be true don't bother to look at that evidence. So then, of course, they can honestly say they've never seen any evidence for that, but that's just talking about the psychology of how people get caught in their belief systems, not science.
Now, researchers who are looking into precognition, are they simply measuring what appear to be instances of it, or have they also attempted to try and explain what they've observed?
The few ones who've tried to explain it are usually physicists who get interested in parapsychology. And frankly, I don't know whether they're on to something or whether they're talking pure mumbo-jumbo.
Yes. What would you like to see change in the way science is taught and the way science is applied in the world today?
I'd like science taught as a process of discovery, not as the final truth of the way things are. I'd like to see it to discourage people to push back our frontiers instead of defending our frontiers.
Yes. Okay. And you are, as well as being Professor Emeritus of Psychology at UC Davis, Professor of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, a field that you were a pioneer in. Just give us an overview of what transpersonal psychology is about.
Right. That's trans as in T-R-A-N-S, the word for beyond, not as in trans, like in a hypnotic trance or something like that. Yes. So transpersonal psychology really could be called spiritual psychology. It's about the aspects of our reality that go beyond our ordinary personal selves. Mystical experiences and things like that. It's taking them seriously and looking at them instead of deciding ahead of time they must be some kind of delusion.
Yes. Charles Tart, author of the book The End of Materialism, How Evidence of the Paranormal is Bringing Science and Spirit Together. He's professor of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, professor emeritus of psychology at UC Davis. He was speaking with us by phone from Berkeley. Charles Tart, thank you so much for joining us.
Good questions, Jeffrey. Thank you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a Sacramento man who's one of the writers of the long-running soap opera Guiding Light, about to be canceled by CBS after 73 years. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's more about our guests and topics at capradio.org/insight. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, she's got an MBA and a $10 an hour sales job. Her previous six-figure salary got the pink slip. Survival jobs and mastering the new economy on Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. Poets Laureate from cities and counties across California are converging on Sacramento for a big reading tonight and to celebrate a new anthology of their work. Two of those Poets Laureate join us, along with the editor of the anthology. We'll start with editor Bob Stanley. Bob, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
What do all these Poets Laureate in tiny towns and big cities do?
Well, they do a lot of different things. They do readings for people. They get groups together to write poetry. They put on events, they build monuments to poetry, but mostly they're just trying to find out what people in the communities want, and then they give that to them.
How many Poets Laureate are there of all kinds in California, do you know?
There's 25 right now.
And these range from tiny little communities to San Francisco, along with an actual Poet Laureate for California.
That's correct. Point Arena is one of the smallest towns that has one, and I think there's about 400 people there.
I see. So your odds of being Poet Laureate of a town that size are, I guess, a bit better than in San Francisco.
That's the place to go.
Now, tell us about this book, this anthology that's connected to the reading tonight. The anthology is called Sometimes in the Open. Does it feature all of the Poets Laureate in California?
It features all 25 of the current Poets Laureate, and then there's about 40 people who have served as Poets Laureate in the past. So some cities, for instance, San Luis Obispo has... They've had 10, and I think we have 9 of the 10 in the collection.
Okay.
So there's 65 altogether.
Also in our studio, one of the Poets Laureate who is featured in the book Sometimes in the Open and also speaking at tonight's poetry reading in Sacramento, he's Dennis Schmitz. He was Sacramento's first Poet Laureate from 2000 to 2002, a position he shared with poet Viola Weinberg. Dennis, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
What was it like being Poet Laureate of Sacramento? Was it onerous? Was it fun?
It was fun. We had many, many projects and successful projects spreading the word.
And what was the goal for you? Was it to write poems celebrating Sacramento? Was it to encourage other people to write poetry?
It was encouraging the love of poetry in the community. And we had several projects, among them the Mondays at the library, the downtown central library, third Monday every month, we had poetry readings. People read their favorite poems, members of the audience. For example, that was one of our projects.
Another one of the Poets Laureate in the book, Sometimes in the Open, and speaking at tonight's poetry reading, is the Poet Laureate of Modesto. He's Sam Pierstorf, and he joins us. Sam, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. I'm honored.
So you're the poet laureate of Modesto. How long have you held that position?
My term, I did two terms. I was the youngest poet laureate ever appointed at 28, and I did two back-to-back terms. I was unanimously appointed again in 2006, and I just finished. And so now I'm just riding the coattails of the anthology.
What were your main achievements as poet laureate of Modesto?
Well, I've got a couple plaques around town from different events that I read for or dedicated a big building, a big hospital. They ended up putting a plaque in an auditorium here at the Modesto Junior College campus. They have a plaque now when they dedicated the auditorium. But I think my biggest achievements have been my monthly poetry slam, which gets about 100 people a month, and then we have this annual event called the Illist Poetry Slam, which gets 600 people every year. So just really, you know, infusing this town with lots and lots of poetry has been probably the most exciting.
The reading tonight in Sacramento is at California Stage, which is in Midtown Sacramento. Let's hear our two poets who are in the book read from their works. And we'll start with Dennis Schmitz, the former Sacramento Poet Laureate. Dennis, in the anthology, there is a poem by you which is from Eclogues, which is a larger work, I suppose.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Tell us what Eclogues. Well, first of all, spell it for us so that people know what it is.
Eclogues.
And what does that mean?
It just means selections. The Latin poets, the Roman poets, wrote eclogues. They're generally selections of poems on nature and that sort of thing.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing then this selection from the larger work, Eclogues, read by the poet himself, Dennis Schmitz, in our studio.
Thank you. Where I lived, the river lay like a blue wrist between the bluffs, and the islands were tiny unctions of green, where every morning the horses outside my house woke the sun, and their breath was like wet foliage in the cool air. But in my house, my bedroom poised between shadow and light, and the light was flawed by angles of glass till night disappeared in a moment of wonder. The farm fed on the full hillsides, and sheets of grain seemed to fall almost to the river shore. But from my window the farm was less real. The river and at noon the fish I could almost hear fading in its cool depths distracted the boy of 12. My brother beside me slept. He was oldest, and duty has deliberate solitude. Even my sisters kept their dolls quietly.
Very nice. Dennis Schmitz reading from his poem, Eclogues. How did you write this whole work? How did you set about writing it? What was the idea? What was the process?
Actually, it's a selection from my first book I wrote almost 40 years ago, 40, 50 years ago almost. And it was a turning into myth the area where I grew up in Midwest along the Mississippi River.
Which was where exactly?
In Iowa, by the Wisconsin border, in the very Midwest of the Midwest.
Yes. So you wrote this a long time ago.
I did.
What's it like for you now at this time of your life to be reading that poem from so long ago? Does it still hold up in your mind?
It did. It does. That particular book was reissued last year by Carnegie Mellon University Press, so in a series of sort of classic writers, and I was pleased to have it revived in that format.
Does it still seem like you, when given that you were living a long way from here and you were a much, much younger person at that time?
It's like looking at a snapshot of yourself if you're looking back to your youth and that's it, you know.
Yes. Dennis Schmitz. Bob Stanley, you're the editor of this anthology. How did you set about choosing each of these poems? And let's be specific about this one by Dennis.
I think Dennis sent me just two or three poems, and this one just stood out. It just seemed very, very specific. The images were strong, and I selected it from the three that he sent me.
So you ask the poets to suggest poems themselves?
Yes. Many of them sent three or four poems. A lot of it came in email. Some people just sent me all their books. And so I had to pick one or two poems from 150.
You had to work harder with them.
Well, a little harder, but I had the pleasure of reading their work, so.
Yes. Tell us what exactly you responded to in that poem by Dennis. What was it that worked so well about that poem?
Well, the closing, my sisters playing with their dolls were quiet. There's just kind of a sense of peace and quiet, and the images are just very strong, the grain and the river, the like a blue wrist or like a blue vein. There's just something, he almost becomes the river, and there's kind of a fusion of the writer and the subject there.
Yeah, Dennis, it does seem a very timeless poem and very quiet and peaceful. Is that what you were looking for?
Thank you. Yeah, that's part of it. It was the first poem in the book, and I wanted to set the tone for the book, and it seems to do that for me still.
Let's go to our other poet, Sam Pierstorf in Modesto. Now, Sam, you have a couple of poems in the book, and I was wondering if you could read for us She Laughs at the Thought of an Ultrasound.
Sure. Of course. Be happy to. This poem's dedicated to my division dean at the time, named Brenda Robert. She laughs at the thought of an ultrasound. In my day, she begins, we had our children on the way to the market, bore them while doing the wash or frying chicken. Between us, there are decades, technological advances that have surpassed even Newton's daydream of things someday falling up. Today, babies are known boys before they can breathe. Girls are visible before all 10 toes have been accounted for. But still I worry. What if the heartbeat bops like Parker's saxophone or stays hushed like the collective silence of pallbearers? These are the anxieties of a new father, I confess, as she looks out the window at the valley oaks, steadfast markers of time, planted before either of us ever considered parenting, before even her own son was introduced without an epidural, before he walked, stumbled, then walked again into the arms of a mother who always knew what to expect.
Wow, Sam Pierstorf reading his poem, She Laughs at the Thought of an Ultrasound. And you said this is dedicated to a former division dean, Brenda Robert. And I should note that you're an English instructor at Modesto Junior College. I haven't heard of a poem before dedicated to a division dean.
You know, it's funny you should say that now. We're in the middle of hiring a new dean, and it's been quite tumultuous. But she left us a few years ago, and she was sort of considered the mother of literature and language arts where I teach. And she was this woman, kind of a maternal figure. I shouldn't say too much. She might be listening, but come out of retirement. But she was a wonderful dean, and I went to her one day because I wanted to sort of get out of a division meeting. My wife we were having our first child, and I was a nervous new father, and she just kind of poo-pooed this idea of ultrasounds and all of these new technologies that all these fathers are scared of. And so the poem is just full of that kind of hyperbole.
Did she know that you were going to write a poem about this?
No, that's people. I think that's the danger of having poet friends. You know, that's what we do. We just you have to be careful around us because we'll write a poem about you. You know, so she absolutely didn't. But I did give it to her when I was done, and she cracked up and she had a good sense of humor about it.
A little bit like knowing a stand-up comic, I guess. You never know what from your life is going to end up.
Right. Yeah. Except nobody reads poetry. That's the problem. So people do go to comedy shows.
Well, yeah, but you said that you get about 100 people to your Slam on Rye poetry series in Modesto. That sounds like a turnout that a lot of comics wouldn't mind having themselves.
Right. No, we're very fortunate. We have just a great town of people eager to hear. And slam poetry comes with its own inherent sort of marketability. You know, you've got these more performance-based poets, so you're sort of watching the poet perform as well as hearing, you know, good content. If a poet comes and just reads a good poem, he's going to get a scorecard with a low score. If he comes and he can perform it and read it well, in addition to it being a good poem, he'll get a high score. And then, of course, it's an open mic, too, so that definitely attracts some people. And there's a lot of purging that goes on, and that's very cathartic for people, too. So it almost has a sort of psychological benefit as well.
When Bob Stanley, who was editing Sometimes in the Open, the Poets Laureate Anthology, and asked you for some poems. How did you figure out which poems to submit?
You know, that's a great question that I don't even think I can answer. I was just talking to my friend last night, and I said, I don't know. I don't remember sending these poems. I don't remember how he got a hold of these poems. So that might be better for Bob. I typically send poems that are shorter and not, you know, slam worthy, which are more like 3 minute long, you know, 2 page poems. So that might have factored into my decision. But I honestly don't remember when I sent or what I sent. But I do want to thank Bob for picking these two, because I like these both. And one represents what I write often about, which is family. And the other one represents what I write about, which is teaching a lot. So,
well, Bob, why did you choose this particular poem? What do you like about it? She laughs at the thought of an ultrasound.
Well, for one, I love the title. It said the title alone was a poem for me. And then it really spanned the generations, the elder way, you know, she bore the child while doing the wash or frying chicken. You realize there's a completely other way of looking at things. And then, and I love the line about, what if the heartbeat bops like Parker's saxophone? I'm a jazz fan, so that worked. Yes. For me. And then shifting, right, a lot of different perspectives. And then coming back to the new father as she looks out the window at the Valley Oaks. And, of course, it's a California anthology, so I was happy to see that there. So there were just a lot of things about this poem that just, yes, it worked in many ways.
Well, Bob, speaking of titles that sound like a poem, your forthcoming chapbook is called Walt Whitman Orders a Cheeseburger, which sounds like a poem in itself.
Well, that's that's been a poem I've had around for a few years, and I just felt it was a good title for the book. So that's coming out in June from Rattlesnake Press.
How many people are speaking tonight at the reading at California Stage?
I think we have 12 laureates coming from all over the state.
Including one from San Luis Obispo, and you mentioned they got like 9 poets laureate there or something like that.
I think tonight we have 2 of the 9 are coming, and there's a reading in San Luis Obispo on May 2nd, and there's going to be a dozen poets down there from various. So there's actually, yeah, it's almost like a poetry tour.
Must be something in the water in San Luis Obispo.
I think so.
Well, thank you so much. Bob Stanley is the editor of Sometimes in the Open, Poems from California's Poets Laureate. It's a publication of Sacramento Poetry Center Press. Several of the poets in the book are reading tonight at California Stage in Midtown Sacramento. 2 of the poets in the book and speaking tonight are Dennis Schmitz, former Poet Laureate of Sacramento, and Sam Pierstorf, who's joining us from Modesto. He's a recent former Poet Laureate of Modesto. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we will indeed talk with the Sacramento writer of Guiding Light, which is about to be canceled by CBS after all those decades on the air. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow you'll hear which Northern California river is being named one of America's most endangered by a national environmental group. Also, string theory, a promising attempt to define the fundamental structure of the universe, but hard to understand. A Nobel Prize physicist will explain all. And the country jams of local band Family with their new album. The longest-running broadcast drama is at risk of going off the air after 73 seasons. It's Guiding Light, the soap opera that started in 1937 on radio and is currently produced by CBS TV. But last week, CBS announced that it was going to drop Guiding Light, and the show's future is uncertain. A Sacramento man is one of the show's writers, and he joins us, Dave Ruppel. Dave, welcome back to Insight. You were on the show about 3 years ago.
Yes, that's true.
Why is CBS dropping Guiding Light?
It's ratings. It's the same thing that I think everything is going through, similar to newspapers. There's just so much more diversity now. There's fewer people at home watching. And so it's just ratings.
And for people in Sacramento who are going CBS, that's Channel 13. I don't remember seeing Guiding Light recently on Channel 13. Why was Guiding Light not on Sacramento CBS affiliate? It's a top 20 market.
Right. Every affiliate has the right to not air any show they choose not to if they think they can put something on better, that will do better in that local market. So I think about 5 years ago, they dropped it. So Sacramento is one of, I think, only two markets in the country that doesn't carry the show.
I read the story in the New York Times the other day about CBS canceling Guiding Light, and you mentioned ratings, and the ratings had definitely fallen. But, you know, the 2.1 million viewers per episode weren't so far behind some other talks like General Hospital and Days of Our Lives that are still on the air. What's different, you know?
Well, the genre as a whole is sort of in a very precarious state. And unfortunately, I think what CBS has sort of announced is probably will be the replacement is a new version of a game show. And they've said they expect the ratings will be less for that, but it's because it's less expensive to produce, they'll make more money. And I think, that, unfortunately, that's where entertainment is going. Not so much about quality, but, you know, how can they make the money the cheapest way possible?
So you think the soap opera genre as a whole is in trouble?
Absolutely. I mean, 10 years ago, there were, I think, a dozen shows on now. And when Guiding Light goes off, there'll be seven.
And do you think we'll see others being canceled in the near future?
Yeah, there are already three that are sort of on death's door. All My Children, As the World Turns, and Days of Our Lives have all been very shaky lately.
My guest is Dave Ruppel, TV writer and producer, who writes for the soap Guiding Light, which CBS recently announced is dropping. Guiding Light is in its 73rd season, including its early years in radio. Ruppel lives in Sacramento. For people who haven't seen Guiding Light for a few years, Sacramento residents, for example, where is it at now? What is Guiding Light about at this point?
It's about, you know, that's the joke, is that, you know, you can not watch for a couple of years, and that's why I think people like these shows is it's a constant in their life, that even if you've not watched for 5 years, you can turn back on and you'll recognize some of the same people, and it's like family. So, you know, we have the typical stories going on, a switched baby and divorce. And, you know, one of the questions a lot of the fans have been asking on the message boards is, are we going to get our pivotal couple, Reva and Josh, back together before we go off the air?
Well, speaking of going off the air, in the New York Times, it seems like it's not certain that Guiding Light will disappear. It's being canceled by CBS, but there's a possibility that it might live on some other network, maybe on cable, maybe on the internet. What do you know about that? And how do you feel about that?
We're produced by Procter & Gamble, and they have made the statement that they're shopping it around. I don't know. It's mixed emotions, because you don't want to get your hopes up that something's going to continue. There is a possibility it could go on the internet. You know, Guiding Light was the first show, serial, to move from radio to TV. It was the first one to expand from 15 minutes to 30 minutes and then 60 minutes. So we have sort of been the trendsetter that way. If that, you know, if that could continue, that would be great. But, you know, once you it sort of feels like, to all of us who work on the show, that we've been given a 6 month notice to live, and you have to sort of deal with that and sort of keep your hopes up. I don't know.
Amazing that it's been on the air since the late 30s.
Right.
But I guess when you get up to the executive level in broadcasting, they're not too sentimental about stuff like that.
No, they're not. Because, again, you know, it's the soap market has a very niche audience, and they're very loyal. But if you're not part of it, I don't think you understand it. But again, I've been reading the message boards, and people's grief is really profound. And the thing that I keep comparing it to is when Johnny Carson went off the air. I myself hadn't watched him for years, but it had always been there, and it was so sad when he went off. It's just an American institution.
How did you get the job writing for Guiding Light? What are the producers of a show like Guiding Light looking for in the writers?
I've been in show business my whole life, and it was through connections. And, you know, they just you have to be able to write for such a wide variety of characters. I guess I fit the bill.
A lot of your experience in TV, especially in more recent years, has been in the reality genre. How does that fit in with soap, which is a scripted format and reality is quote-unquote unscripted?
It's all storytelling. You know, no matter what I've done, people expect a beginning, a middle, an end. You know, they want to learn something about the characters. They want to feel something about these people. They want to be compelled to tune back in. So it's similar, but it's not.
Speaking of which, this has been an issue between the writers and the TV production companies, this whole notion of what exactly reality TV is and what it takes to make it. And you've been active at the union level on this issue, representing daytime TV writers, and you were strike captain in the 100-day strike from late 07 to early 08. Where is all that now? Have the TV production companies accepted or not the role of the writers in these genres?
Oh, no. They know that there are writers, which, again, let me be clear. It's not that we never tell anyone what to say, but there is still there's still creative minds coming up with formats and plot lines and things like that. And they know writers exist. They just don't want to pay them union wages. So that's really been the issue.
You live in Sacramento. You moved here a few years ago. Has that been held you back in any way in your career because so much of this production happens in L.A.?
No, that was a choice I made. And you know, the nice thing about working in daytime TV is that you don't have to live in the city that the show is produced. Actually, Guiding Light is produced in New York. I may have to be moving back to L.A., you know, when the show goes off the air, because that is where the majority of the work happens.
That, of course, would have an impact on your husband, Fred Palmer, who's the publisher of the magazine Outward. And he happened to be on Insight last week, and it was he who reminded us of your situation, which is why you're on today. Where does Fred fit into that? You're married to him.
Yeah. Well, it's not an easy thing. The first 3 years we were together, it was a long-distance relationship. And, you know, I can't complain too much. I know people who've had to go from L.A. to New York, so an hour-long flight to L.A. isn't the worst thing. It's not the best thing. But, you know, we've been together 6 years. We'll work through this.
Tell us how you do your job as one of the writers of Guiding Light. How much are you told, you know, Dave, we want this, this, and this to happen in the episode, make it happen? Or is it more like, Dave, give us an episode?
We have a nine-person writing team, and we write 250 episodes a year. Once a week, we have a conference call that lasts about 3 hours, where the head writers go over what we want to happen in the week, and then the five of us go off and each write one episode a week.
When you look at what's on TV today, what's your favorite reality show other than the ones you've worked on? Or if it is one you've worked on, that's fine.
It's funny. I don't watch as much reality TV as I made. I used to like American Idol. I'm not particularly – the singers this year aren't really captivating me.
So it's because of the singers you're not interested in it,
yeah.
Not because of the
yeah.
something inherent in the show.
Right, right.
Okay. Well, do you know what's next then for you?
No. I mean, fortunately, we don't go off the air till September, which means the writers will be working probably till the end of June, which, you know, gives us all some time to absorb this and sort of figure out what's next. And if there is a possibility it's going to continue, we'll hopefully know before then.
Yeah. Well, best wishes.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
As Dave Ruppel, TV writer and producer who writes for the soap Guiding Light, which CBS recently announced is dropping. Guiding Light in its 73rd season, including its early years on radio. Ruppel lives in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a local production of The Gondoliers, the comic opera by Gilbert and Sullivan. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions. Send them to insight@capradio.org. Later today, I'll be at the Mondavi Center moderating a panel discussion about the line between memoir and fiction. Speakers include Sacramento literary agent Andrea Hurst. One of her clients was Herman Rosenblatt, the Holocaust survivor who made up important elements of his life memoir. Hurst stopped representing Rosenblatt when she learned of the deception. Today's panel discussion starts at 5 at Mondavi Studio Theater. Admission is free. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, retirement out of reach for an increasing number of Californians. A new report today from the California Budget Project shows the share of people between the ages of 55 to 69 who continue to work has increased significantly since the mid-1990s. That story and more later today on All Things Considered. One of the most popular comic operas is at Sacramento State this week. It's The Gondoliers by Gilbert and Sullivan. In our studio is the director of the production, the conductor, and five of the singers. Welcome all to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
We'll start with Michael Sokol, the director. Michael, the operas of Gilbert and Sullivan are very different from what you would get from, say, Puccini or Wagner. What can you expect? I guess that's the answer.
Oh, nobody dies.
Not in this one.
Well, what can you expect from a comic opera like The Gondoliers?
What you can expect is a fun-filled romp. we have, of course, there's the obligatory stolen baby and the mix-up in identities and, you know, just easy, pretty, and fun.
And witty lyrics, that's one of the hallmarks of Gilbert and Sullivan.
The libretto is brilliant.
Yes.
It's brilliant.
Tim Rolick, you're conducting it.
Yes.
And you're also the artistic director and conductor of Sacramento Opera.
Right.
Which, I will note, presented Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirates of Penzance last November.
Right. It was our
first
foray. Yeah, it was a complete coincidence. When we did it in November, it was the company's first chance at Gilbert and Sullivan repertoire. And, you know, I love this stuff. I grew up with it. And the political satire for me is something that's timeless, even though it's over 100 years old. The jokes are about kings and queens and political parties are just as funny today.
Because the gondoliers in this story, even though they've been given this great gift of knowing that one of them is going to be the king of this fictitious kingdom of Barataria, are Republicans, heart and soul. And so they decide that
Republican, capital R. Not
Republican.
Not the elephant type. You know.
Correct.
Thank you.
And so here we have a monarchy that's based on Republican principles, that there being the political satire.
In our studio are five of the singers from Sacramento State in this local production of The Gondoliers. There are Alan Presley, Elizabeth Berkeley, Harry Sadler, Andrew Nicol, and Sarah Hoagland. And they're going to sing for us. Michael, you're the pianist for this particular version. So if you could step over to the piano. And Tim, this they're going to sing Here Is a Case Unprecedented. Tell us what we need to know.
This is a quintet, and this is where they're trying to figure out who is going to be king and which of their wives will then be queen.
Okay, well, let's hear it when we're ready.
Here's a case unprecedented. Here a king and queen are sought. Ever since marriage was first invented, never was thrown a case so hard.
I may be said to have been bisected by a profound catastrophe.
Through a calamity unexpected, I am divisible into three.
I may be said to have been bisected.
That's wonderful. Here's a case unprecedented from the Sacramento State production of Gilbert and Sullivan's The Gondoliers. Let's quickly talk with one of our singers, the singer in the middle. I don't know who you
That's
are.
Liz.
Say your name, please.
My name is Elizabeth Berkeley, I'll be playing Casilda.
Now, tell us what it's like to sing this, because it sounds like a real tongue twister, as is often the case with Gilbert and Sullivan.
And she's the one who gets it right.
It is a tongue twister, but it's a lot of fun. And it just takes a lot of hard work to sing it over and over, and you start really slow and faster and faster.
And you're not just saying these words, of course. You're having to project with a big voice because this is an opera.
Yes, it's true.
Well, Tim, can you contrast that with singing the libretto in grand opera, where the libretto, the words are often a little sparse? It's fewer words repeated many times.
Right, for dramatic or tragic operas, but there's a history of what's been known as patter songs from Gilbert and Sullivan of rapid-fire text. It goes all the way back to Mozart's time and started with Mozart and then went on to Rossini and Donizetti and the comic operas that went through the bel canto, and even into Johann Strauss as well.
Michael Sokol, how do you approach directing the singers in this work?
Well, we looked for some sort of context to make it fun and different for us here. So I looked at the Hollywood glamour movies of the 30s and thought that the set for Top Hat in Venice, since this takes place in Venice with our two gondoliers, might be a good place to put the show. So that was my inspiration, as well as the drawing room comedies like Dinner at Eight from the 30s that gave it a context.
The Gondoliers plays later this week, April 9th and 10th, at Sacramento State University Theater. We have, well, let me just confirm, is it a song or an aria when it's Gilbert and Sullivan, Tim?
Well, aria is Italian for song, so they're all songs.
Sure, but you always see aria when it's, let's say, Puccini.
Right. I would say these.
Well,
are
the English guys used to call them air.
Right.
Just to make the difference and to turn it into an English thing.
But Gilbert and Sullivan were also very specific about their intent in saying that we want to create a new art form of British comic opera to compete with what was happening on the continent at that time with Johann Strauss and Kalman and those guys.
Queen Victoria had wanted Sullivan to be more serious, but this is the only opera that she had them come take to the palace to play before her.
Well, we have time for another aria, song, air, whichever word we're going to use. Michael, do you want to step over to the piano again? Tim, this one is called One of Us Will Be a Queen. Anything we need to know?
No, again, this is the two wives of the two gondoliers trying to figure out which of them is finally going to be a queen.
Okay, four of our singers, all of them are stepping up.
Then one of us would be a queen and sit on a golden throne, with a crown instead of a hat on her head and diamonds of her own, with a beautiful robe of gold and green. For I've always understood, I wonder whether she'd wear a feather. I rather think she should.
Wonderful. Tim Rolick, conductor of this production of The Gondoliers, we often hear the word Savoy opera used to describe Gilbert and Sullivan. Just quickly, what does that mean?
It refers to the theater in the Savoy Hotel where these things were first presented.
So the impresario d'Oily Carte raised a lot of money and owned the Savoy Theater and started a big enterprise there.
Yes. Now, if Gilbert and Sullivan were working today, would they be producing, do you think, for Broadway in the London West End, or would they be more at the art end of music?
Well, there you have the dichotomy. So Sullivan, who was the big classical musician, as a younger man, said, let's do some of this fun stuff with Gilbert, who definitely was West End.
Right, and I think they would still be making great political satire along the lines of, like, the Capital Steps group.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so much in this. There's, we're talking about companies that bubble in this, and we're talking about the liquidation that happens with the very poor and then the very wealthy Duke of Plaza Toro. So it's very current. And, yeah, it would be West End. His other shows were done in the West End. So, yeah.
Tim, having worked on this here and obviously the Pirates of Penzance with Sacramento Opera, is there a different audience for Gilbert and Sullivan than there is for the other kinds of opera at Sacramento Opera and other opera houses?
Well, I think there is, and it's an audience that is much more, I think, musical theater savvy than you find in an audience that will see La Bohème that we'll do in a month's time. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, Michael Sokol, the Gondoliers this week, Thursday and Friday?
No, Friday and Saturday.
I'm sorry, Friday and Saturday.
Uh-huh.
And when and where?
Friday at 8 o'clock and then Saturday at 3 o'clock at the University Theater, Shasta Hall on the campus of Sac State.
Well, thank you so much. That's Michael Sokol. and also Tim Rolak. They're the director and conductor of this production of The Gondoliers, and some of the singers, Ellen Presley, Elizabeth Berkley, Harry Sadler, Andrew Nichol, and Sarah Hoagland. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on the guests and topics you hear on our show, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Rebecca Markison, and Mara Ponce. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Northern California River will be named one of America's most endangered by a national environmental group. On the next Insight, we'll talk to local experts about what can be done. Also, string theory is a promising attempt to define the fundamental structure of the universe, but it's hard to understand. A Nobel Prize physicist explains what string theory really means. And the country jams of local band Family. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.